Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
First things first, I'm the realist. Drop this and let the whole world feel it.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. According to the calendar, it's still spring for another week. But according to the music blogs, websites, and magazines, the song of the summer, that warm weather party anthem you'll be hearing on repeat for the next few months, is all but decided. Here to discuss this year's contenders and why the song of the summer is even a thing is Joe Levy. He's editor-at-large of Billboard. Hi, Joe.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. So we've got our leading contender, I think, Iggy Azalea's hit single Fancy, which I've read in a number of places, is the probable choice for this year's song of the summer. Can you tell me why?
I can, but I just want everyone to know there's still time. There's still time to change the course of the song of the summer. We're just getting started. Iggy Azalea right now is at the top of the Billboard Hot 100. It seems like it's the song of the summer for two reasons. It's the biggest song in the country, and you're hearing it everywhere, which is the number one requirement for a song of the summer. And it's summery. Iggy actually told us at Billboard that she had written this song as the ultimate L.A. driving around song. That's what it is to her, and apparently other people agree.
I'm so fancy. You already know I'm in the best lane. From L.A. to Tokyo, I'm so fancy. Can't you taste this gold? Remember my name. To blow.
And it seems like the marking point is Memorial Day. That's when people start counting, right?
Yeah, I think that's when people in general think the summer has kicked off, and that's when we kick off our summer songs chart. So we have that online. It updates every week, but what it is it's going to be a cumulative chart. All the things that go into calculating the Billboard Hot 100 go into that, and that includes radio play, sales, streaming. So you listen to music on YouTube, we count that. And it's a good and accurate picture of what the most popular song this summer will be.
Okay, so you mentioned with Iggy, you know, one of the qualities that we're looking for is a song that you can sort of, you know, stick your arm out the window while you're driving to the beach, you know, blasting on full volume. What are some of the other qualities you would say usually apply to the song of the summer? Very danceable, party vibe?
Danceable party vibe, because it is a danceable party time of year. I think we all agree that the song of the summer in general is the song you can't get out of your head. It is inescapable. You cannot get away from it, and sometimes you want to and can't, and sometimes you don't want to because it's bringing back all the good memories of that fun time.
Your description makes me think of Pharrell's song Happy might have been perfect, but I feel like that one kind of peaked, maybe right after his performance at the Oscars?
Yeah, you know, it's the unfortunate thing. It is a perfect summer song. Pharrell did produced last year's Song of the Summer. That's Robin Thicke's Blurred Lines. So
Oh, yeah. He's
got that vibe down really well. He knows how to make a happy, in this case, danceable, fun song. But yeah, the timing on that one just didn't work out perfectly for Song of the Summer this year. It's still on the charts. It's still a hit, but it's unlikely to dominate over the next few weeks and months.
With the air, like I don't care, baby, by the way. Because I'm happy. Clap along if you feel like a room without a roof. Because I'm happy. Clap along if you feel like happiness is the truth. Because I'm happy. Clap along if you know what happiness is to you.
Okay, so I noticed, I was looking at some of the other, you know, top songs at the moment. Calvin Harris has got a song called Summer that's at the top of the charts. And I was wondering, do artists, you think, actually pursue this song of the summer status?
Well, in this case, I think you have to say yes. I think if you're Calvin Harris and right before the summer, you're releasing a party anthem about remembering meeting you in the summer, you know, I think that's scientifically engineered to be a summer hit. And there are a couple of other dance guys who actually are trying to get in on that action. Tiesto, huge DJ, has a song called Wasted. It's not about wasting time. It's about partying too hard. And again, this is a song that's just out. It's just building now. And I think it's one that he and the record company are trying to engineer as a contender for Song of the Summer.
I like us better when we're wasted. It makes it easier. Say yeah, yeah, yeah. Lay all your laundry off the bed. Then I lay it instead.
So what do you think, if it's not going to be Iggy, do you see any other songs maybe sneaking past her, you know, throughout this summer? What about Ed Sheeran? He's got that song Sing. Pretty much sounds like they cloned Justin Timberlake circa 2002. I need you, darling, come on, set the tone. If you feel the falling, won't you let me know? Oh. I think that could be a sleeper hit.
I don't think it'll sleep. I think it'll actually be a hit. The number two contender also involves Iggy,
yeah.
And it's Ariana Grande's Problem, which has been a huge hit. It hasn't yet peaked. It hasn't gotten to number one. Iggy Azalea's featured on that song, but she's the one keeping it out of the number one slot. I think it will go to number one eventually, and I think it's a contender.
Do you think it's part of the whole song of the summer thing is that by the end of the summer, we're totally all played out? We're so sick of this song, we don't want to hear it anymore?
Why? Are you feeling particularly upset about 2012 and Call Me Maybe?
Well, there's only so many times a song can be used in an internet meme, right?
Yeah, I think that on the one hand, you want a break. You know, it's a little bit like saying at the end of the summer, do you want another hot dog? You know what? I'm going to take a break. I'm going to like lay off the backyard barbecue for a second. But there'll come a point in a few months when it's cold, you'll be missing it, and you know what? Iggy Azalea or Ariana Grande is going to come back around, and you might actually have some instant nostalgia in December.
So, you know, speaking of December, what do you think it is about summer that we want an anthem for it? It's not like we spend time debating the song of the winter or the song of the fall.
You know, we don't, but it's really funny. There is that tradition in England of the Christmas number one.
Ah.
There's actually campaigns. It's a battle to get to number one right at Christmas week. You know, it's true that we don't debate what the song of the winter is. And I think it's because this is a special moment. You grew up, you're off from school, the radio dominated your life then, and that's when you formed memories of sitting around with nothing other to do than head to the beach, listen to music, have a good time.
Okay, so you're a numbers guy. I'm going to give you a chance to maybe get off the charts for a second. What are you listening to this summer?
Wow. I am actually looking forward to the Ariana Grande album, some of which I have already heard, and I'm going to say it's pretty good. But I'm listening to an up-and-comer. His album isn't out yet, but it's fantastic, Sam Smith.
Okay.
You know him from the Disclosure song that he sings on, and of course he's got his own hit right now, but the whole album is fantastic. It's more down-tempo and lovelorn than I think your normal summer anthems might be, but it's going to be a big album this summer. Oh, won't you stay with me? 'Cause you're all I need. This ain't love, it's clear to see.
All right, well, Joe, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Joe Levy is editor-at-large for Billboard. You can find a link to Billboard's Songs of the Summer chart at wordofmouthradio.org. And not everybody is into Iggy Azalea and Pharrell, so we charged our intern Molly with coming up with a list of alternative summer anthems for 2014. You can check out her playlist at wordofmouthradio.org. But you can lay with me so it doesn't hurt. Oh, won't you stay? And we move from the songs of the summer to the songs of the pitch, the worst World Cup songs the world has to offer in 2014 when word of mouth continues. But darling, stay with me. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. Before the break, we discussed the contenders for this year's Song of the Summer. Well, there's one track you're bound to hear for about the next 4 weeks anyway. We Are One by Pitbull and J-Lo, the official song of the 2014 World Cup. Put your flags up in the sky. Put them in the sky. Check it out the world. Ain't got no side to side. Show the world where you're from. Show them where you're from. Show the world. We Are One has its fair share of critics for reasons both political and aesthetic, but let's face it, there are worse options. Joining us now from Brazil to talk about the worst songs inspired by the 2014 World Cup is Ryan J. Bailey. He writes for Yahoo Sports soccer blog Dirty Tackle and speaks to us now from Brazil, where he's covering the World Cup. Hi, Ryan.
Hi there. Pleasure to be here.
So what's your take on We Are One? What do you think?
Well, in the vast pantheon of World Cup official songs, I don't think it's very good. You look back at, say, the 2010 song, the Shakira song, it was quite catchy. It was called Waka Waka, This Time for Africa, which right. sounds a bit Muppets-like to me, but it was a good, entertaining song. This Pitbull and J-Lo one's a bit bland, it's a bit cliched, and as you say, it's not been received very well in Brazil and around the Latin American countries.
Well, you did have a chance to see Pitbull perform the anthem live at the opening ceremony last Thursday. Was it any better in person?
No, the actual open ceremony, it was a very strange event. You know how the Olympic ceremony is this grand event where it celebrates the host country? There was none of that in this Brazil opening ceremony. And the main event was Pitbull, who was actually joined by J-Lo in the end. She got out of her contractual obligations and appeared. And it was just bizarre. The song, you know, a very muted response from where I watched it on the Copacabana in Rio.
All right. Well, so moving on to some World Cup songs our listeners have probably avoided up until now. Maybe that's a good thing. Let's start with Macaroni, one of two British songs on your list. What makes this one particularly loathsome?
I think you just have to listen to about 5 seconds of it and you realize it. It's a takeoff of the Macarena, of course, that song that took us all by storm in the 1990s. But with it's devoted to Wayne Rooney, the England striker. And the video for it, I don't know if you can get your listeners to check it out, but it's people dancing wearing paper masks, and it's quite cartoonish and nightmarish.
All right, we will make them check it out, but in the meantime, here's a listen. Come on, England, let's do the Macaroni. Doesn't even matter if you sing it out of tune. We are England, Team England. Hey, Macaroni, hey! When I play you to the Macaroni, with my skills I send the fans loony. Move past you, run round you, I'm so good. Make a fool of ya. Come on, England, let's do the Macaroni. Doesn't even matter if you sing it out of tune. We are England. Okay, so probably not going to win a Grammy this year. Let's move on to another song from the list, also from England. This is Greatest Day by Gary Barlow and Friends. Today this could be the greatest day of our lives. Ryan, if you told me this song was on the Twilight soundtrack, I would believe you.
Well, this was actually a very popular song in England a few years ago by Gary Barlow's band Take That, but it's been reworked for the England team. That opening refrain there was sung by Gary Lineker, who's an absolute hero in England. He was a striker back in the 80s and 90s. But as you can see, he's not quite got a voice for to carry a tune. Now, this song is so bad, in fact, it was chosen as the official England song, but they got rid of it. They dumped it, and they even took it off of iTunes just before the World Cup.
Ouch, that's rough.
Yeah, it is.
So is that a trend? Is that a trend that we see, you know, former soccer players or soccer players joining in on the musical madness of the World Cup?
You do get that occasionally, yes. And in this particular instance, there's about 15 or so former England players singing along in the chorus later on in the song. Yeah, but from around the world, you do get some former players trying to test their vocals. Like, I think on my list also, I've got a song with featuring Diego Maradona. Diego Maradona is an Argentinian legend. There are churches devoted to this man in Argentina, such is his fame and his infamy on the soccer field. It was 1986 when he lifted the World Cup for his country, beating England along the way, I might add. And he has a strong backstory. he's had trouble with alcohol. He's had trouble with substances in the past. But he's never shown us his singing voice before. And he's done so on this song, which also features his daughter. The song's called Gritandole al Viento, which apparently means something like shouting into the wind. Now, I don't know, if I'm listening to a romantic World Cup song and it's called Shouting into the Wind, it doesn't quite evoke the right imagery for me.
Very poetic. Okay, here's an American song, actually, that made the list, a little surprising, with a tongue-in-cheek country ballad, strangely enough. This is Red, White, and Blue by Fusion. Because if there's any demographic in the U.S. that loves soccer, you know it's country music fans, right?
Yeah, it's quite the crossover, this, isn't it? It's very interesting. I should say at this point that there's a history of World Cup songs that they're always slightly terrible. There's always slightly, there's always something tongue-in-cheek about them. They're never going to be amazing pop songs that reach number one spot. They've always got this slightly cheesy edge to them. I really, really hope that this song is tongue-in-cheek because it's got some cringe-worthy lyrics in it. One of them that I enjoyed the most was, "The Germans thought that 2002 was just revenge for World War II." That's rhyming two with two there, by the way.
And of course, the video for this features, as you would expect, a blonde wearing cut-off jeans, dancing in front of an American flag, to lyrics such as the one that you just mentioned.
That's right. Yeah, it's got all the traits of a proper country song, and it also mentions a truck. I think it mentions a dog. I think there isn't a single country song that doesn't mention those two things.
Okay, the last song on your list, the Venga Boys song "To Brazil." They had a couple hits in the '90s, most notably "We Like to Party." I think everybody will remember that one. Now, I'm not really sure who they're rooting for in this World Cup.
The Venga Boys, well, they're Dutch, actually, but this song seems to be a general "Let's celebrate the World Cup" song, which is for the global appeal, I suppose. Brazil! The boys in Rio got that boom, 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 boom. The girls in Rio be like zoom, 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 zoom. Zoom, 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 zoom. Zoom, 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 zoom. Copa, Cabana, São Paulo, Fortaleza. The beat don't stop in every villa and favela. And
speaking of videos, again, this one, one actually I couldn't watch in the office, not safe for work. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, yeah, I don't think many people can watch it in our office. There's a censored and uncensored version of this video. Suffice to say, it entirely consists of ladies who have misplaced the upper half of their clothing.
Now, is that a World Cup trend I just didn't know about?
Well, actually, I've spent yesterday on the Copacabana beach in Rio, and it's definitely a World Cup trend here, I should say. But it's not one I was aware of until I got to Rio. But I'll tell you something about this. The censored version of this video, which you can find on YouTube, has about 25,000 hits. The uncensored version has about 3 million hits. So you can probably tell why people like this song if they do.
So what is it about the World Cup specifically that inspires all these songs? You know, I know there's official tracks for the Olympics and some other big sporting events, but it doesn't seem to get taken to the same level that it does for the World Cup. What do you think it is?
It's quite an odd phenomenon, really, because even since 1966, when England hosted, that was when the first World Cup song came out, and it's just become a bit of a tradition, really. Some of them have become more anthemic than others. I think people who remember the 1990 World Cup in Italy, it was soundtracked by "Nessun Dorma," sung by Pavarotti, and it perfectly fitted the drama of the event and the emotion. And then in 1998, France had a song, "Allez le Coupe du Monde" or something like that. But it was a song that didn't have any vocals. But it's just whenever you hear it, you think of France 98. And it's just, I don't know what it is about it. It's something about the way the music culture and football culture fit together around the world.
All right, Ryan, before we let you go, predictions on who's going to take home the cup this year.
It's going to be very hard to see Brazil not take the World Cup. The home advantage in this competition is so important. And, of course, Brazil have a really good squad at the moment. So if it's not them, it's going to be someone like Argentina, their South American rivals, or perhaps Spain, who are the current holders of the World Cup, of course.
Well, Ryan J. Bailey, thank you so much for taking time out of your very busy schedule in Brazil to share some truly awful songs with us here in the States.
Pleasure's all mine. Thanks for having me.
Ryan Bailey writes for Yahoo Sports soccer blog Dirty Tackle. He's in Brazil for the next month covering the World Cup. If you'd like to hear those songs one more time or see some of the ridiculous videos that we mentioned, you'll find them all on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And coming up, when TV leads get pregnant. From Lucille Ball to Kerry Washington, the industry's weird tradition of covering up, or weirder yet, incorporating an actress's baby bump into the script. Stay tuned for that story when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott today. Fans of ABC's Scandal love to see crisis management expert Olivia Pope keep Washington's worst skeletons tucked neatly in the closet.
You keep everything from me.
To protect you. And don't ask me to apologize for it or punish me when I tell you the truth. This is what we do.
This season, though, the show has kept its most tantalizing secret a little closer to the chest, or should we say stomach. Whether it's a well-placed lamp, an oversized purse, or a throw pillow, ABC has used every directorial trick in the book to keep lead actress Kerry Washington's pregnancy hidden from the camera. Discerning fans have taken to looking for these cover-ups as a sort of internet parlor game, but as writer Logan Hill observed for Los Angeles Magazine, working around pregnancies is practically an old tradition in TV. Hi, Logan.
Hi there.
So you write about some of the kind of wacky ways that shows are hiding or even incorporating actresses' pregnancies, but it wasn't always that way, was it?
No. It's an interesting story in Hollywood, kind of a sort of one of those industry shadow stories. You know, it begins with pregnancies being dangerous and sort of forbidden for actresses. And you know, the idea was a young starlet, it could destroy her career or sort of block her from being able to take on a major role for a while. And there are stories, almost sort of nightmarish stories, of producers escorting actresses to get abortions, pressuring them into having abortions, and then otherwise firing them from jobs. You know, there used to be a time where if you got pregnant, that was it. Now, I think, the power of women in Hollywood has changed. We've developed all these amazing workarounds, you know, from costuming to silly props to now using CGI in new shows like Homeland.
Not to harp on a kind of disturbing point, but I was really shocked to learn reading your article that Judy Garland was pressured into having an abortion and actually was brought to the clinic by a studio executive.
That's right. In 1942, MGM executives really felt like, especially for someone like Judy Garland, whose sort of girlish image, you know, the sort of naive, lovable
Dorothy.
Girl next Dorothy. Exactly. Yeah, you know, that Dorothy could not have a bump. Because it would also imply that at some point she'd had sex, and God forbid that, you know. So they were really, back then, at the studio system was much more involved in protecting the images and guarding the images and managing the images of young stars.
So things have changed. Times are a little more progressive now, but for shows that do choose that cover-up route, you write that the kind of camera tricks we saw this season in Scandal, they have been around a very long time, pioneered, in the 40s.
Absolutely. Yeah, you go back to the 40s and you've got Veronica Lake showing up on the set of Sullivan's Travels and shocking Preston Sturges, who had actually asked her if she was pregnant, and she had lied to him. And then, you know, working with the legendary costume designer Edith Head to develop these beautiful costumes, you know, that just kind of cloak it with A-line cuts or sweaters or big handbags and that kind of thing. And that's the exact same thing you see used on most television shows right now, you know, whether it's How I Met Your Mother, whether it's Seinfeld, whether it's, any of these shows now, you know, including Scandal, where, yeah, it's old-fashioned cuts. Like, I interviewed a costume designer for shows like Mad Men and Deadwood, and she basically said, you know, there's a lot you can do with both cloaking and misdirecting attention. You know, it's not just sort of hiding the belly. She said sometimes it's putting the emphasis on the new cleavage that a pregnant mother might have, and sort of directing the eyes away from the belly.
Yeah, viewers are so predictable that way, I suppose. So when, I guess, did things change? When did we start to see pregnancy written into the script?
The first time it changes with Lucille Ball. You know, it's the second time on television ever, and certainly the biggest. They actually felt like they couldn't use the word. The network said, you cannot use the word pregnancy. You can't use the word pregnant.
It was expecting, right?
Expecting, exactly.
Honey, no.
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Why didn't you tell me?
Why, you didn't give me a chance.
Are you kidding?
No.
It's me!
When little Ricky is born on that show, 44 million people tune in, and it kind of turns people onto the idea that maybe this isn't such a shameful thing. Maybe this isn't something that should be kept off of television. But, you know, at the same time, you have to deal with the dramatic consequences of this. So pregnancies become more common, and on something like a soap opera, pregnancy can actually be a great plot point. But the question becomes, what do you do with that baby after the character gives birth? Do you want these sexy characters on a soap opera like General Hospital to suddenly become mothers? Well, no, you don't. So in one of the most gruesome traditions on television, you have over and over again soap actresses pretending to have miscarriages while pregnant with their real children, just because they couldn't miss 6 months of a season of a show that shoots a couple hundred episodes a year. And now, you know, it's we're in this kind of interesting space where there have been some discrimination lawsuits filed and won, bosses really can't say, producers can't really say, we're going to kick you off the show because you're pregnant. They legally have to work with some of these actresses.
And yet it can be a difficult situation for women who are trying to plan pregnancies potentially in between jobs. Why do you think that some actresses, a production company is really willing to cater around their pregnancy and some other actresses might sort of get the shaft?
Yeah, like everything else in Hollywood, it's all about leverage. It's all about how big of a star you are and how much they need you. You know, Hollywood never sort of bends over backwards to pay anybody more money than they have to or make any accommodations that they don't absolutely have to. But if you're at the top of that food chain, they will work with you because they know that the reason they have that show, the reason they have a hit show like Homeland is because of Claire Danes. The reason they have a hit show like Scandal is because of Kerry Washington. So it really depends. If you're a supporting actress on one of these shows, you are vulnerable. And I interviewed Busy Phillips, even, who's, you know, a legitimate star. She's doing great on Cougar Town. She auditions for a show a couple of years ago, shortly after her pregnancy, and the producer said, look, we just don't believe that you're going to lose this weight fast enough. And even though she was the first choice of the showrunner, the producers loved her, they didn't give her the part. She lost the role. And she's still upset about it, and she still feels kind of vindicated that her career has gone on since then. But unless you are indispensable, they're really not going to work with you to the extent that they will if you're going to be the person on the poster.
Well, I want to get to some other examples of some shows that have either covered up or incorporated pregnancies. There was Phoebe in Friends. You also mentioned Julia Louis-Dreyfus in Seinfeld.
Yeah, it's interesting that comedies have kind of had a lot of fun with pregnancies in general. You know, even the Cosby Show kind of made big displays of Felicia Rashad's back pain to get her in the bed, and they actually cut a hole down into the mattress so that her body would sink down in the mattress and hide the belly, which she had a big belly. They raised the kitchen counter in the kitchen to hide her belly a little bit more. Yeah, and then on Seinfeld, they basically tried to hide it and then just began making jokes about her weight eventually. Daphne on Frasier, ends up getting sent away to a fat camp and then is described as losing 9 pounds, 10 ounces, you know, yeah. The joke. But that was really cringeworthy and I think one of the most awful treatments of it. But, you know, in other shows, they've got, you know, people like Lisa Kudrow on Friends who became a surrogate for her brother. So they'll write it in as a plot point. In a way that's maybe a little bit lighter and often temporary, in a way that allows them to not deal with, Lisa Kudrow's character actually having her own baby.
Ho, ho, ho.
Excuse me?
Your pants.
Oh, yeah. You like them? I went to a used clothes store and got, like, a bunch of maternity stuff. These are so comfortable.
Phoebe. Those are Santa pants.
What?
Santa pants. Santa Claus's pants.
you've got to appreciate that it's become something of a Hollywood trope if comedies get a little meta about it, you know, willing to poke fun at themselves and in their own workarounds.
Yeah, my favorite really has got to be How I Met Your Mother, where Allison Hannigan has a hot dog eating contest. Right? She wins the contest. So the big reveal, the big punchline of the hot dog eating contest is that she shows her real belly, which is, you know, 8 months pregnant. It's great to see that kind of thing. Or even on 30 Rock, where they, instead of using like simple costumes like a blousy dress, they used full-on dog costumes and ridiculous sort of theme park costumes and just went for it.
You know, some of the tricks that they used in Scandal, you know, the big handbags and the big coats. I mean, there's something really funny about seeing ways that you could try and cover up something that's very difficult to cover up. But it's kind of sad, too. It speaks volumes about, I guess, the uncomfortable degree of weight that the industry places on body image.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, even when actresses are perfectly healthy and fit and tiny, there's still someone in Hollywood who's going to say they need to lose another 15 pounds. So when they get pregnant, of course, there's like just a greater degree of scrutiny. The kind of thing that you see these baby photos and or photos of pregnant actresses in magazines, and they're talking about how much weight they've gained. And you know, well, of course they've gained weight; they're pregnant. And what's interesting now is I think you have women playing very powerful roles on these shows, and there haven't been too many shows that have really tried to combine the pregnancy with the idea that somebody could be fighting crime or terrorism and also be pregnant at the same time. And for all the times that you notice it, now what we're seeing is in big budget shows like Homeland, that you can actually cut Claire Danes' face off, stick it onto a skinny model's body with CGI, and to a degree where I would have never noticed the special effects if Danes hadn't told me that herself in an interview. It's just almost impossible to detect these days.
So do you see, you know, Claire Danes, Kerry Washington, these increasingly creative ways of covering up pregnancies? Is this a progressive step in the right direction for women working in television, or is this just all about the money?
Well, I think you have to look at it as a progressive step, because not only are people like Claire Danes and Kerry Washington able to continue working, you know, whereas a number of years ago they just would have lost their jobs. But it's certainly not a utopian working condition, but it's better. And then I think it's also paired with this idea that women in Hollywood are becoming more powerful as producers of their own projects. You know, people like Danes are becoming more involved behind the scenes. People even like Courtney Cox, you know, Busy Phillips was talking about working with Courtney Cox and how just having Courtney on the other side of the table in these business meetings meant that she had a level of security and comfort knowing that they could work with her. And the more that this happens, I think the more comfortable studios and producers are becoming with the idea of working with a pregnant actress. But does that mean there's not actresses still today losing their jobs, not getting cast in roles? No, it doesn't. It's still a very serious issue. So it's progress, but it still has a ways to go.
You can read Logan's article for Los Angeles Magazine at wordofmouthradio.org, where you'll also find a link to some pretty funny GIFs highlighting all the conspicuously placed objects covering up Kerry Washington's belly during the last season of Scandal. Logan Hill, thanks so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you.
We're having a baby, my baby and me. You'll read it in Winchell that we're adding a limb to our family tree.
Even when you're not a working actress, pregnancy can be a joyful time, miserable, or anywhere in between. But one of the hardest parts of parenting comes long after the labor is finished, getting your toddler to eat his or her vegetables. Some surprising findings on why convincing your kids to eat healthy is having adverse effects on their health when word of mouth continues.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. For any parents out there, it's an all-too-familiar scenario. You're trying to coax your child into eating something like Brussels sprouts, broccoli. Your argument might sound something like this. It's good for you. It will make you strong. Or, when I'm trying to get my 2.5-year-old son to eat, vegetables give you superpowers. Well, back away from the dinner table, recent research from the Kellogg School of Marketing shows that telling kids that the food they're eating is good for them actually makes them less likely to eat it. Michal Maimaran was part of the team that conducted the research, and she joins us now to discuss her findings. Michal, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to talk about my research.
As I mentioned, I have a 2.5-year-old. Have I caused him irreparable damage by telling him broccoli is going to make him stronger? Or does this research only apply to a certain age range?
Well, I wouldn't want to think that you've already caused damage that cannot be repaired. Probably your son already has formed some associations that you try to convince him to eat the vegetables and the food that is less tasty. But I think that even at the age of two, if we as parents stop convincing our children to eat and simply serve them the food, as my research suggests, it should have good results. And as a mom of three young kids myself, I have a 7-year-old, 4-year-old, and a 2-year-old, I also stopped telling my kids why they should eat certain foods. And recently I actually noticed that my 4-year-old, he just spontaneously says, "Look, mommy, how strong I am," without me telling him anything after he ate his vegetables or salad.
Oh, that's just adorable.
Thanks.
Can you tell us about the Wheat Thin experiment?
Sure. So this was, I think, the first experiment that we actually ran. We had about 60 kids participate in this experiment. Each child did the session individually. And what we did, we read each child a short story about a girl named Tara that likes to eat Wheat-Thin crackers before she goes out and play. Some of the kids learned that Tara felt strong and healthy after eating the crackers. Some of the kids learned that Tara thinks the crackers were yummy. And some of the kids did not learn anything about the crackers. And then we offered all the kids to eat some Wheat-Thin crackers. We had a bowl with 15 crackers. And we find big differences in how much kids actually ate depending on what story they heard. So when they heard that Tara thinks the crackers made her strong and healthy, children ate on average 3 crackers out of the 15. When we told them that Tara thought the crackers were yummy, children ate on average 7 crackers. But when we told them nothing about the crackers, whether they're yummy or make them strong, anything, kids ate the most. They ate on average 9 crackers.
I can see why kids might not really care whether a food is good for them. That might not convince them whether or not to eat something. But I guess I find it strange that saying a food is healthy actively deters them from eating it. What are your theories about why this is the way it is?
So what we think that's going on is that children think that food cannot have more than one goal. So if I tell them that the food is good for them, the food is healthy for them, they conclude, okay, the food cannot be also good for my taste goal, meaning it's not also tasty. Therefore, they eat less. Now, I want to add that we didn't use just health goals in our studies. We also used, if you want to say, academic goals. In some of the cases, we told the kids, Tara from the story thinks that the carrots will help her know how to count, or the carrots will help her know how to read. We told them that's what the girl in the story thinks.
Sure, brain food.
Yes, and we still find the same effect. Whenever we tell the food serves a certain goal, kids eat about half the amount compared to when we say nothing about the food, no goal that it represents.
Do you think that a 3 to 5-year-old even understands the concept of health then?
Yes, I think so. So we did one pretest in this project where we asked kids what they think healthy eating means. About half of them say it indeed means, you know, being strong and good for me, gives me energy. About, I think, 25% of them or so said eating your vegetables. And the rest, again, about 25% or so gave just unrelated answers, such as eating soup or eating breakfast, and some just didn't have an answer. But for the most part, most of them know what healthy eating means, and they give theories that are consistent with what we think healthy is. Good for you, makes you strong, helps you grow, and eating your vegetables.
What is the best approach then for trying to get kids to eat foods like their vegetables?
I would just suggest serve them the food without any sales pitch, without trying to convince them why they should eat the food. Just sell the food and, you know, hope they're going to eat it.
And if they don't?
If they don't, just try again. I know that it's very tempting to keep convincing the kids. I do it myself, and my husband is like, Michal, you should know better. This is your research. I know how tempting it is. But if you believe the results we have across 5 experiments with almost 300 children, it seems that just serving the food repeatedly should yield better results than trying to convince the kids to eat the food.
Now, what about incentivizing a child to eat, you know, something that you want them to eat in order to, say, get dessert or get the tastier part of the meal? So if I said, if you eat your broccoli, you can have some ice cream after dinner. Any thoughts about that?
So this is not something we tested. This was something they tested in other research papers. And for my reading of the literature, these strategies also fail. If you make the food a contingency to receive a future reward, just like you said, if you eat your broccoli, you get dessert, kids like the broccoli less.
Oh, man, this is like no way to win.
Well, just serving the food, being a role model. There's also research talking about being role model. If the kids see you, the parent, the caregiver, eat his vegetables and the healthier food, this plays a big role in what they eat.
Well, Michal Maimaran, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you very much, Taylor.
Michal Maimaran is an assistant professor of marketing at the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University. You can read more about her research at wordofmouthradio.org.
I'm going to be around my vegetables. I'm going to chow down my vegetables. I love you most of all, my favorite vegetable.
In truth, my son is pretty good when it comes to eating his veggies, as long as there isn't a sweeter option on his plate. He eats broccoli, beets, spinach salad, but there is one food we haven't yet tried together, and I'm not sure he would go for it, but it sounds like there are a lot of reasons to give it a try. Emily Friedman has more on a classic Korean dish.
Kimchi may be one of the world's most versatile foods.
I was actually making omelets for my colleagues, and they're like, oh, you know what would be good with this? Some kimchi. And, you know, it goes with a lot of things.
That's Adam Wojciechowicz.
Not a Korean name, a Polish name. I'm part of the local staff here at the Korean Cultural Center.
He says, when it comes to kimchi, there's a very common narrative. It starts when you try kimchi for the first time. You like it, you try it again, and pretty soon, it's all kimchi all the time.
When you're having like a hamburger and you get a craving for kimchi, you know you've crossed over to the kimchi side.
Now, in South Korea, just about everyone lives on the kimchi side.
Kimchi is our life. That's how serious we are.
Young Lee has worked as a chef in the U.S. for more than 30 years. Most Koreans, she says, eat kimchi at every meal. It's common for Korean families to have a whole extra refrigerator just for kimchi. And for kimchi lovers, the process behind the dish is often a mystery. So I asked Chef Lee to reveal how she makes her signature cabbage, or pechu kimchi. She starts with cabbage, though not the kind that looks like a bowling ball. She likes Chinese, or Napa cabbage, which has longer leaves.
Napa cabbage has a more crunch.
Earlier in the day, she had sliced each cabbage in half and sprinkled it with lots of salt. This is how the cabbage starts to pickle. Now, a few hours later, it's ready for the next step. Chef Lee combines red pepper paste, turnips, salt, garlic, fish sauce, and green onion to create a bright red paste. That's called the stuffing. Then, one by one, she coats each leaf of the cabbage with the stuffing.
This is the motion I put it, but don't put too much stuffing because it makes it later does not really look nice.
The final step is rolling up each cabbage using the big outer leaves to keep in the stuffing. Then she packs them into a clay jar where the cabbage sits and ferments for a few hours, a few days, even a few months. But you can also taste the kimchi right away, which I did.
That's very good.
Cabbage kimchi is the most ubiquitous of all kimchis, but according to Adam Wojciechowicz, it's just one recipe out of hundreds, maybe thousands.
So you've got all these different kinds of vegetables that you can make into kimchi. You can have cucumber kimchi, you can have cabbage kimchi, radish kimchi, onion kimchi.
Oisobegi, chonggak kimchi, every kimchi has their own way to express themselves.
And if you go to a Korean restaurant, it's likely your table will be covered in kimchi.
Basically, Koreans don't like to see the table is the way that I sum it up. The more dishes, the better.
Promoting kimchi is part of South Korea's official state policy. But even without that mandate, Wojciechowicz says Koreans around the world would still put in the effort. First of all, they like to eat it. And secondly, it's a constant link to Korean culture.
There's a lot of different elements and there's a lot of history that just goes into this one little side dish. So I guess calling it a side dish might be a little misleading. In a lot of ways, it's kind of the highlight because that's where all the flavor is. And that's the thing that people kind of crave. It's really, you know, a whole genre in itself.
A genre that's about preserving not just cabbage or cucumber, but the culinary history of an entire nation. I'm Emily Friedman.
Thanks for joining us today. If you haven't tried kimchi, give it a shot. Tell us what you think at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us, send us your feedback, or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and Twitter. After all, the most fascinating stories tend to travel by word of mouth. I'm Taylor Quimby. Virginia Prescott will be back tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.